Queensland federal government has this morning promised $3.5 billion for a climate solutions fund to deliver on Australia's 2030 emissions target. More than half the money will be injected into the government's emission reduction fund. The National Farmers Federation has welcomed the investment and says it will create opportunities for land managers. Our reporter Kath Sullivan asked the chief executive of the NFF, Tony Maher, if he expected the fund could lead to more land being locked up.
Locking up land is not something that we want to see. What we want to see is measures and projects and initiatives that allow farmers to continue growing their business, but also doing what they can and engaging where they can in reducing emissions to have benefit on their farms. A lot of farmers have got opportunities to make or have alternative incomes while reducing emissions, but while also growing their farm.
How does this really affect day-to-day practice on farm in Australia in 2019?
What it can do, essentially, is that, say, Joe or Joanne farmer that's got in the paddock and it's got a potentially unproductive paddock that was cleared however many years ago and might suffer from whatever it is, dry land salinity or something, the fund or emissions reduction fund could potentially plant trees in that paddock, increase the or reduce the salinity management, and also capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and provide the farmer with a range of benefits. So that is a very simplistic way of where something like the old emissions reduction fund and this new Climate Solutions Fund can help farmers engage in the emissions reduction effort, but also possibly bring benefits, including potential income source for the farm.
But realistically, we don't know how many people are going to benefit or have benefited to date.
I don't have the exact numbers on how many farmers have benefited. What I do know is that farmers want have engaged and want to do more. The methodologies aren't well enough developed to do that right at the moment. But farmers across Australia are managing climate change and climate variability, and they're ideally placed to engage and participate in this discussion. So more funds to allow us to better engage, understand the research and what it means for farm productivity and growth and profitability at the end of the day, I think is a good thing.
Carbon trader Ben Keogh welcomed the investment by the federal government this morning, but suggested there were other and in fact better ways that could help the trade.
Particularly with farmers, generally you're looking at largely soil carbon and forestry carbon or vegetation carbon projects, which are by definition long term. So to have rules changing regularly creates a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace and a lot of uncertainty for farmers about exactly what they're going to get and what they have to deliver. So to have a lot more consistency and certainty around that would certainly, I think, allow farmers to enter the market with a lot more confidence.
Are there more farmers prepared and in a position to enter into the market, given we've seen some pretty rough years, particularly on the East Coast in recent times?
Yeah, it's the drought certainly would be affecting the ability for farmers to revegetate or sequester soil carbon. It also would be have them looking for alternative income streams, which carbon can be one. The first three auctions were very successful under the Emissions Reduction Fund. I think they took around about 150 million tonnes out of the environment over a long period of time. The last three auctions was 15 million tonnes. So if we look at the $1 billion or the $2 billion that's been put in, you're not talking a lot of money every year, maybe $200 million a year into carbon reduction, which might get you maybe 20 million tonnes a year. It's not a hell of a lot of money. I think the government needs to open the market a little bit and probably strengthen the safeguard mechanism.
The safeguard mechanism, can you just explain that?
Well, the safeguard mechanism is essentially a cap on the amount of emissions that the company is allowed to produce through their facilities. So once they exceed that threshold, then they need to offset those excess emissions, and they do that by purchasing carbon credits. So if that was stronger, then more companies would be purchasing more carbon and the market would be driven and it wouldn't need to come out of taxpayers' funds.
Anna Bosted from the Indigenous Carbon Industry Network says the savannah burning industry in northern Australia has grown to be worth about $16 million a year. She said that that industry was hopeful there'd be a shift away from the Emissions Reduction Fund and to an open carbon market.
Our preference would be to see opportunity for polluters to directly purchase carbon credits from carbon credit generators, so that that would then enable groups to attract higher prices for their product. Yep. And the Indigenous carbon industry businesses are able to attract a much higher premium price because of all the additional benefits they deliver to the environment and culture and society in general.
That's Anna Bosted from the Indigenous Carbon Industry Network, and that report put together by Kath Sullivan. You're listening to The Country Hour, 12 minutes past 12. A couple of texts have come in, and Magpie and Orange says, what a great idea, using taxpayers' hard-earned money to pay companies for reducing their carbon emissions. A little bit like paying a thief to stop hitting you, according to Orange. To Magpie and Orange. And Graham's texted in saying the research on climate change emissions reductions has found that the emissions from politicians has caused immense damage to the country. The development of hoods that fit tightly on all politicians' heads have been found to greatly reduce this source of toxic emissions, according to Graham. You might have some thoughts on the announcement, $3.5 billion for the Emission Reduction Fund. 0467 922 684 is the number to text us here at the Country Hour. Well, last week, the US climate gurus finally declared that we're definitely struggling with an El Nino, albeit a very weak one. Professor Steve Turton says that conclusion has been drawn mainly from the very warm sea temperatures we're seeing to the north of Australia. He says this has shifted weather patterns to the south and setting up blocking highs have been holding the warm air over New South Wales and Victoria and holding those rainfall systems stagnant over North Queensland, like we've seen in the last few weeks or so. Central Queensland University Professor Turton says the wild weather and heat waves are something we're going to have to get used to.
Well, that's right. I think, you know, for a start, I think this sort of summer began in earnest in November with the bushfires in Queensland and heat waves in the north and massive heat waves in the south as well. So this has kind of started with more or less beginning of summer, early November, right through to the present. We've had these series of extreme events. We have to keep in mind that Australia is the land of extremes and it's you know, part of our natural variability to have these extreme events. But the anthropogenic global warming of our atmosphere, particularly our oceans, this is where the big effect is in our oceans, is actually punctuating these events when they do occur, these extreme events. So we're not, you know, no one is denying that we've not had high variability. You know, that's been well known since the settlement of Australia. And of course, traditional owners would have responded to that variability as well for many millennia. But we're now living in different times where we are seeing this punctuation. And recently, we've seen it with pretty well most of the East Coast, the South, the North, Tasmania. I guess the West has missed out a little bit this year. They've been fairly average. So we have seen particularly this blocking high system sitting in the Tasman Sea that has actually affected the weather patterns not only in southeastern Australia, but also it's affecting Tasmania, but also in New Zealand as well. So they've had prolonged drought in the North Island of New Zealand as well. So they're not the only ones suffering at the moment.
That blocking high phenomenon we have talked about a little bit, and it really has just sort of stops those streams of rain events to come across New South Wales, and that's what people have been complaining about for the last couple of years.
That's right. I don't know whether, you know, one of the drivers, I suspect, Michael, is the warming of the oceans, which I mentioned before. We kind of don't think about them, but they're kind of the elephant in the room in many ways because we're a terrestrial animal. We live in the atmosphere. We don't live in the oceans. But the oceans are taking up a lot of heat, and we're seeing changes in ocean currents. So, for example, the East Australian warm current that moves down our east coast, it's now becoming a lot stronger. It's moving much further south, and it's having a much greater influence down into New South Wales, even down into Victoria and Tasmania. And it's leading to changes not only in wind patterns, but also in currents as well. So, for example, there's changing erosion patterns on the Victorian coast. And this possibly, you know, this is certainly linked to the blocking high that we've seen. But on the other side of the coin, it can also be implicated when we get blocking lows, these East Coast lows that probably are friends to farmers because they bring rain in, particularly south of Brisbane, right down to Victoria. They're known as cut-off lows or East Coast lows. They can be can lead to significant flooding, although they don't always bring a lot of rain west of the Great Divide. They tend to be more along the coast. So both sides of the coin is that this current can have two effects. It can it can feed, you know, feed into these stagnant highs or blocking highs, as they're called, which, as you say, they stop the cold fronts coming through during the summer. Sydney gets these southerly busters sometimes during the summer. They're all being pushed south and making their way below the blocking high rather than coming up into New South Wales.
And those blocking systems also have blocked the rainfall over places like Townsville, and that's why we saw the system just sit there for days on end, whereas normally it wouldn't do that, and the flooding was extreme.
That's right. In many ways, I guess they say in meteorology, the high, the Tasman high, if you like, cradled the monsoon low up there in the Gulf Country, and it just happened to sit where it did. It could have, you know, that rainfall convergence could have been over Cairns, it could have been over Mackay, but it had to sit right over the largest city in northern Australia, a very flat city at that. So, yes, that was kind of linked in many ways to the blocking high. The other thing that's important for rainfall in western New South Wales is the inland trough. Now, the inland trough extends up into Queensland as well. It's a summer phenomenon, and it sort of moves backwards and forwards between being west and east. And it does generate up to 80% of the local rainfall in those western districts. It's quite an important generator of rainfall, as it is in western Queensland. What's happened is that blocking high has created these onshore trade winds, these easterlies, and that's actually pushed the inland trough further west. So it's pushed prospects for any rain development out of that region of western New South Wales and western Queensland, the area that is currently drought-stricken, south of the area where the monsoon low affected. So the monsoon low didn't really bring much rain south of about the Flinders Highway, which runs from Townsville across to Mount Isa. So, unfortunately, the rain was restricted to areas pretty well north of there.
And that's why we didn't see any inflow into the Darling River, which we do normally see when we see rainfall in Queensland. But it was just too far north, and again, it was blocked there.
That's right. I mean, if that high had weakened, you know, everybody was praying it would move inland as a wonderful rain depression and make its way right down into New South Wales, which would have been a saviour. But that blasted high... high-pressure ridge sort of kept it sitting there, and then eventually it wandered off into the Coral Sea. Yeah, no, in terms of the continuation of the drought, until we get a breaking down of these patterns, it's going to be a long, hot, dry summer, I think, until maybe we get into the autumn and we might see an East Coast low form.
And the forecast, too, from the Bureau is we're looking at almost certainly El Nino and drier than average. That's for the next 3 months. That's highly likely in your book?
When they give the seasonal outlook, they don't just look at the El Nino Southern Oscillation. They also look at the phase of the Indian Ocean Dipole. And they look at the Southern Annular Node, which is the Southern Hemisphere, Southern Ocean mode as well.
But in terms of what you're seeing in the changes, those blocking highs, those... changes to the weather systems, we're seeing the inordinately high sea temperature in many areas. This is, you think, there's no doubt, this is global warming impacting our weather systems now.
Yes, what we're seeing is we're seeing this background warming of the atmosphere, but particularly the oceans. You know, the rainfall figures that we saw in North Queensland have broken all records. One in a 2,000-year event for the upper Ross River Dam in Townsville, one in a 500-year event for the Townsville Ross River. These are kind of off scale. So yes, we will still have variability in Australia because we've always had a highly variable climate, very erratic. But we will increasingly see punctuations driven by background warming of the oceans and atmosphere. So the answer is yes, this is climate change. We're living with it now.